Lecture 4, Northwestern University, Materials Science and Engineering 405, Physics of Solids, Professor Mark Persom, September 22nd, 2006.
All right, let's get started. Last time we covered an arbitrary time-independent potential, and we saw many consequences of a time-independent potential. Today and for the next week or so, we're going to consider specific time-independent potentials in one dimension, and then move on to three-dimensional solutions of the Schrodinger equation. The potential we're going to start with today is that of a free particle, which at first glance should be the simplest potential you would think. A free particle implies that the potential is zero. Classically, we know what a free particle does. In particular, classically, a free particle, because there's no force exerted on it, will not be accelerated. And as a result, it travels at a constant velocity. That velocity is uniquely defined by the energy. In particular, the classical velocity will be equal to the square root of 2e over m. Since we know that e, if there's no potential energy, is just the kinetic energy, which is 1 half mv squared. So if we solve this for velocity, we'll of course get square root 2e over m. So classically, we know that's what a particle will do. It will travel at this constant velocity as dictated by its energy. Quantum mechanically, of course, what we have to do is solve the Schrodinger equation. But because this is time independent, we can go directly to the time independent Schrodinger equation and then add the known time dependence, e to the negative I e t over h bar, once we've done solving the time independent Schrodinger equation. So we will begin, quantum mechanically we must solve the time-independent Schrodinger equation. And in this case, because there's no potential energy, it's just the kinetic energy, minus h-bar squared over 2m, second spatial derivative of psi is just equal to e psi. Okay? This equation, we're going to rewrite in a way which is going to allow us to solve it easily. In particular, we'll recognize that we could write this equation, this differential equation, in the following form. The second spatial derivative of psi is equal to negative k squared times psi, where k is equal to the square root of 2me over h bar. All I've done is move this term to the right-hand side of the equation and then define a new term, k. The reason why we do this is that this differential equation is one which we probably all have solved before. The solution of this equation can either be written in terms of sines and cosines, or alternatively in terms of e to the ikx and e to the minus ikx. Of course, we could convert between those two forms of the solution using Euler's formula. E to the ikx is cosine kx plus I sine kx. In this case, it's going to be particularly useful for us to write it in terms of e to the ikx and e to the minus ikx. And as a result, we can see that the solution to this differential equation is just a e to the ikx plus b e to the minus ikx. If that's not obvious, you could just plug it in, take two derivatives of this, and show that it's equal to that. Of course, this further implies that the total wave function is psi, lowercase psi, times e to the minus I e t over h bar. And so that would be equal to e to the I kx times e to the minus I e t over h bar plus b e to the minus I kx times e to the minus I e t over h bar. One thing that we'll recognize is that we could solve this equation for E, and as a result for a free particle, we'll see that the energy is h bar squared k squared over 2m. This is not necessarily that meaningful yet, but later on we'll see that whenever we have a quadratic dependence of k for energy, that it's going to imply a solution of very similar form to the free particle. Of course, any function near its minimum, if we were to Taylor series expand it, could be approximated as a parabola. So any material, we're later going to talk about band structure and EK relationships, any material near a minimum or a maximum in its EK diagram will behave quadratically and as a result very much like a free particle. The only difference between an electron in a solid and an electron in free space is that the concavity of the EK diagram could be different in the solid. The only term which dictates concavity in this equation is the mass, and as a result, in a solid, we're going to define an effective mass which will describe the concavity of the EK relationship near a minimum or a maximum. The point is that this solution which we're doing today is arguably the most important for solid state physics, because at any band edge, we're going to see a free particle-like solution to the Schrodinger equation. That's why I stress this one, and we bother going through it in gory detail, because it's very important. Okay. Today, of course, we're just talking about a free particle in free space, and so it's just the free electron mass. The point I'm making here is that we can see this relationship between E and K, so we could plug this into this equation here and express this in terms of K only. And as a result, capital Psi for a free particle can be written in the form A e to the I kx minus h bar k squared over 2m times t, where I've plugged in this value of E here, and of course the h bar squared and h cancel, so we just have a h to the first power here, k squared over 2m times t, plus B e to the minus I kx plus h bar k squared over 2m times t. This solution, e to the I kx minus some omega t, where we see omega is h bar k squared over 2m, is a form of a traveling wave. In particular, when there's a negative sign here, it implies a traveling wave to the right, whereas when this is a plus sign, it implies a traveling wave to the left. So the free particle solution to the Schrodinger equation leads to two propagating waves. One to the right, and another one which is propagating to the left. Okay? This is what we would have expected to occur if we didn't know the Schrodinger equation, only knew about de Broglie's formula. Remember, de Broglie would argue that particles have wave-like nature to them, and as a result, a free particle should travel and behave like a wave. So this is an example of wave-particle duality. Is everybody okay with this solution thus far? Question?
Can you explain the significance of this idea of two waves, one to the right and one to the left?
Right. Of course, all we've done now is found the general solution. These terms A and B are complex constants. And depending upon the initial conditions, one of those could be zero. So it's possible that you just have something propagating to the right or to the left. We're going to see in a minute that this general solution to the Schrodinger equation, this stationary state solution to the Schrodinger equation, I should say, is actually not going to be normalizable, and as a result, in and of itself, will not be a physical representation of reality. So you don't need to worry too much about the details yet, because we're going to show in a minute that this solution is invalid. Okay? So that's why the free particle is an interesting problem. The differential equation is trivial. It took us two lines to solve it. But physically, there's already some problems which are triggering your head. What does this mean? Leftward propagating wave, rightward propagating wave. And it's even worse than that, which we'll see in a minute. Okay? Any other questions? Yeah, the free particle is very subtle and interesting, as we'll see. One thing which is typical in the free particle solution is to recognize that these two equations, or these two terms, are equivalent. Okay, one is left, one is right. We could write them as one term if we let k be positive or negative. Then we would contain both. So if k could have any value, then we could just write down one solution. And so that's typical to just write down the solution in terms of some index k, which is just equal to a e to the I kx minus h bar k squared over 2m times t, where k now can be plus or minus square root 2me over h bar. Obviously, the plus sign refers to a rightward propagating wave. The minus sign applies to a leftward propagating wave. We're going to see in a minute that for the free particle, k is a representation of momentum. And so what we're saying here is that this wave function would describe the behavior of a free particle for any momentum, either positive or negative. Obviously, if it has positive momentum, then it's going to move to the right. If it has negative momentum, it will move to the left in a one-dimensional coordinate system. So let's put that in firmer ground. Why do I think k is representative of momentum? Well, we can see that the stationary states are propagating waves. Of course, if it's a wave, it has a wavelength. The wavelength, lambda, is just 2 pi over the magnitude of k. Okay, hopefully that's obvious. Whenever you have a sine function, say sine kx, its wavelength will be 2 pi over k, because it's just basic trig. So we see that these propagating waves have a particular wavelength related to k, but we know also from de Broglie's formula that momentum is just h over lambda. And as a result, if we plug this value of lambda into this equation, we see that momentum is just h bar times k. Right, so we're going to take the reciprocal, we get h over 2 pi, which is just h bar, and 1 over lambda is just going to be proportional to k. So we see that k is basically a representation of momentum for a free particle. That's also important because later on when we talk about EK relationships in solids, you'll ask, well, what the heck is k? And as long as the dispersion relation is quadratic, that is, you're near a minimum in the EK relationship, k will be a good representation of momentum. And so that's going to be a fair approximation for many physical processes in solids. This is the first time where we see this put on firm theoretical footing. Okay. We could ask other questions. This is a propagating wave, so we can calculate the velocity of that wave. And of course, the magnitude of velocity is just the speed. So the speed of these waves is going to be given by the coefficient in front of t divided by the coefficient in front of x. Normally, when you write down the plane wave solution in, for example, electromagnetism, you'll write it in the form of e to the I kx minus omega t. And the velocity of that would just be omega over k. That is, of course, the case here. And as a result, if we took this term and divided it by that term, the velocity, which I'm going to call v quantum, which will compare with v classical up above, is just equal to h bar times the magnitude of k over 2m. But we know that the magnitude of k is just square root 2me over h bar, and as a result, we can plug that into this equation. And what we'll see is that the quantum velocity is equal to square root e over 2m, which is very similar to the classical velocity, except now it's off by a factor of 2. So this is equal to 1 half v classical. And now this seems very unusual. Why is it that a quantum system propagates at half the speed of a classical system? So this should be bothering us. And we'll come back to this in a minute. But as I already alluded to, it's worse than that. Because if we simply try to normalize the wave function, we'll find that it's not normalizable. So obviously this is not the whole answer anyway. So we're going to find later on that we can correct for this by constructing a real wave function which is representative of reality. Okay. So this is concerning, but more concerning is the fact that this wave function is not normalizable. Okay. In particular, if we try to normalize, we'd have to take psi sub k star times psi sub k and integrate over all space. We can see here that the complex conjugate of this is just e to the minus I times this argument here, and so when you multiply them together, all that survives is the magnitude squared of the constant out in front. And so this is simply equal to magnitude squared of a times the integral from minus infinity to infinity dx. Of course, the integral of dx is just x. The value from infinity to minus infinity is twice infinity, or infinity. And as a result, this is going to be equal to magnitude squared of a times infinity, which is clearly not normalizable. And as a result, what we would conclude from this condition here is that although we did the math correctly throughout this, is that a free particle cannot exist in a stationary state. So this is what I'm alluding to. In this course, the math really isn't the point. You can do the math perfectly fine, but you'd get the wrong answer if you didn't recognize the physics of the problem. So what we conclude from this is that the free particle cannot exist in a stationary state. In other words, there's no such thing in quantum mechanics as a free particle with definite energy. So classically, it's easy for us to imagine a billiard ball with a given energy. In quantum mechanics, there is no such thing. Free particle in quantum mechanics, you have to abandon the notion of definite energy. Similarly, we'll have to abandon the notion of definite momentum. So there's going to be a spread in momentum. And from Heisenberg uncertainty, we'll know there'll be a spread in position as well. So we're not going to be able to localize the free particle. Or if we localize a free particle, we'll know absolutely nothing about its momentum. So the free particle is a dramatic example of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Any questions so far? So the question is, what do we do? How do we move forward? If you recall last time, what we showed is that the stationary state solutions make up a complete set from which we can build the general solution. And how we did that is that we assumed that there were a discrete number of solutions to the Schrodinger equation, and we would take an infinite sum and calculate the constant C sub n for each of the stationary state solutions to construct the general solution. In fact, as soon as you have more than one stationary state solution, you abandon the notion of definite energy. So this is not hard for us to accept. What's a little bit more interesting in this case is that k is just momentum, and in principle, the particle could have any value of momentum, so k is a continuous variable as opposed to a discrete index. So instead of building up an infinite sum of the stationary state solutions, we have to go to the continuous variable representation of an infinite sum, which of course is simply an integral. So we're going to describe now the wave function as an integral over the stationary state solutions. Okay. So let's go ahead and do that. the general solution will therefore be equal to an integral from minus infinity to infinity, since we said k can take negative values as well, times some parameter which will represent the c sub n. That parameter is historically been given the following form: 1 over square root of 2 pi times phi. This 1 over square root of 2 pi is just a constant. The reason why it's there is to make this conform with the theory of Fourier transforms. We're going to find that we can go back and forth between phi and psi using Fourier transform theory. That's the only reason why it's there. Times the general solution, which we know is e to the I kx minus h bar k squared over 2m times t dk. As I've alluded to, 1 over square root 2 pi phi dk plays the role of c sub n. Remember, c sub n is a weighting parameter. It tells you how much of the wave function is made up of stationary state 2, 3, etc. So phi is going to tell us the contribution at a particular momentum to the overall wave function. So if phi is a peaked function about some value k naught, that tells you that mostly the momentum is at k naught with some spread given by the spread of phi. The more spread out phi is, the less we know about momentum, and as a result, we would expect from Heisenberg uncertainty principle that we know more about the position, and vice versa. This function can be normalized. That's good. It also represents that we're abandoning the notion of definite momentum, as I've been alluding to. This notion of having an infinite sum, or in this case, in general, an integral over plane wave solutions is known as a wave packet. It's a packet of plane waves, where each plane wave is weighted differently based upon how much momentum exists for each of those waves. Okay, this is a wave packet. One thing that you may know from trigonometry is that when you start to sum together different sine, cosine waves, is that that resulting sum will have some interference. And as a result, instead of that sine or cosine function being distributed over all of space, it will become localized. The fact that it becomes localized is why we're able to normalize the function. Also tells you that the wave packet will tell us that we know something about the spatial position, not exactly where it is, but it will be localized at some point in space, with an uncertainty which is something we can calculate precisely. Okay. Everybody okay with this notion of a wave packet? Incidentally, as I've alluded to many times, in a solid, the free particle solution will be approximately correct as long as we introduce a new effective mass. And as a result, we're going to treat electrons and holes moving through solids as wave packets propagating through free space with some different mass. So this is absolutely critical to understanding the simplest electrical properties of a material. So it is relevant to material science. We are getting there eventually. Okay, so let's try a problem to practice. As in any quantum mechanical problem, we're typically given, or we create an experimental situation where we know what the wave function is at t equals 0. So we know the initial conditions, and we need to find how the wave function will evolve as a function of time. So this is your general problem in quantum mechanics. So how do we do it for the free particle? The first step is that we're going to recognize from this general solution that psi of x, comma 0, if we plug t equals 0 into this equation, is equal to 1 over square root 2 pi integral minus infinity to infinity, phi k, e to the I kx, dk. Okay. So all I've done is plug t equals 0 into this general form. And obviously this t term cancels and we just get this integral here. We're given this, so the only thing we don't know is phi. So we should be able to calculate phi from the initial condition. The way in which we do this is to take the Fourier transform. So step number two is to Fourier transform this equation here. To find phi. Remember last time we said that once you know what the stationary state solutions are, then we use the initial conditions to determine the C sub n values. Once you have the C sub n values, you're done. You just plug them back into the general solution. For the free particle, phi is C sub n. And so once we find phi, we're going to plug phi back into the general equation and we're done. So this Fourier transform is the whole problem. Once you do this, it's basically over. The Fourier transform to calculate phi in this situation is equal to 1 over square root 2 pi. So you see why we use that term, because it remains constant in the Fourier transform. Integral minus infinity to infinity capital psi x comma 0, which we know, e to the minus I kx dx. So we're given this. All we have to do to find phi is do one integral. Now, if you've never had Fourier transform theory before and you're interested in it, then you may want to refer to Shalom's outlines or some mathematical handbook to learn about it. To be perfectly honest with you, all you have to do is be able to execute this integral to do it. So it's only for your own edification if you want to learn more about Fourier transforms. It's not really the point here. However, if you are whiz with Fourier transforms, it makes life a little easier. There are lots of tricks, and if you're, in particular, an electrical engineer, Fourier transforms are the heart of a lot of problems, and so you may have more experience with it. Okay. Step number three is, as I already said, to plug phi into the general solution. Which we know is just equal to 1 over square root 2 pi integral minus infinity to infinity of phi, which we've just determined, times e to the I kx minus h bar k squared over 2m times t dk. All I've done is written this down again. And you'd have to do a second integral. So any free particle problem boils down to doing two integrals. The second integral often is not solvable analytically, and so you'd have to numerically calculate it. I'll give you an example in the homework where you'll solve it analytically. In particular, the Gaussian wave packet will be solvable analytically all the way through. So you get to do a couple of integrals. So that's really all there is to it. What we're now going to do is an example problem, and then look at the result and talk about it in the context of Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Let's try an example. A free particle initially located or localized in the range between minus A and plus A is released at t equals 0. So assuming we have some experiment, we can localize the particle in this region in space where it's going to let it go and see how it evolves. Mathematically, you describe the situation as psi of x, 0. It's going to have some amplitude capital A in this range. and zero probability being located elsewhere. The first step in any of these problems is to determine the normalization constant capital A. And so we will do that. We'll first normalize. If you recall a couple lectures ago, we showed that once you normalize at any time t, it remains normalized for all future values of time. So we might as well use the simplest time, which is t equals 0. To normalize this, we say that 1, the normalization value, is equal to the integral over all space of the magnitude squared of psi at some value in time. We're choosing t equals 0. This value here is just the magnitude squared of a, but the bounds of the integral, instead of going from minus infinity to infinity, will just go between minus a and a, because it's 0 everywhere else. And as a result, this will just be equal to the magnitude squared of a times the integral from minus a to plus a dx. The integral of dx is just x evaluated from a to minus a, and as a result, this is equal to 2 times lowercase a times the magnitude squared of capital A, and that's equal to 1, so we can then solve for capital A and see that a is equal to 1 over square root of 2a. So that's step 1. Everybody okay with that? So now we know exactly what psi is at x, 0. So we've taken this word statement and converted it into something mathematical. Now the rest is just following the procedure I've outlined. Once we know what psi is, we take the Fourier transform to determine phi. So phi will be equal to 1 over square root 2 pi. We get the 1 over square root 2a from the normalization constant. Integral from minus a to a, because that's the only place that capital psi is defined, e to the minus ikx dx. Okay, the integral of e to the x is just e to the x. We're going to keep in mind this term here, minus ik. And as a result, this integral is just equal to 1 over 2 square root pi a, where I combine these two terms out in front, times e to the negative ikx divided by this term here, negative ik, integrated from minus a to plus a. So we plug in the two bounds of the integral. We're going to get out 1 over k square root pi a times e to the I ka minus e to the minus I ka over 2i. And I've written this down in a suggestive form because this term here in the parentheses is simply equal to the sine function. If you were to employ Euler's formula on each of these terms, this would be cosine ka plus I sine ka. This would be cosine ka minus I sine ka. So the cosine terms would cancel. The two I sine terms would add together. You divide that by 2i and just get out sine ka. So I'm going to further write this in the suggestive form with some further manipulation. Square root a over pi sine ka over ka. Because the function sine x over x is known as the sinc function, for those of you who have seen the sinc function before. So the Fourier transform of a rectangular pulse is the sinc function. Those of you who have done Fourier transform before probably know that very well. That's the prototypical first Fourier transform you do in any math or electrical engineering course. Okay. The last thing we have to do is plug phi into the general solution. And as a result, we now know that capital psi at all future values in time, which is what we are after, is equal to 1 over pi square root a over 2 integral minus infinity to infinity of sine ka over ka times e to the I kx minus h bar k squared over 2m times t dk. Now, in general, you'd solve this integral and you would be done. It may or may not be obvious to you, but this is not an analytically solvable integral, so you'd have to evaluate it numerically. And I'll show you a plot of it in just a minute. In general, though, if this is analytically solvable, you should go ahead and plow through the integration, and that's what you'll do in the homework for the Gaussian wave packet. So I'll show you the numerical solution in general in a minute, but before we do that, let's consider a couple of limiting cases. So that's a very common thing to do in physics, to find the general solution and then consider limiting cases, which are easier to handle mathematically and give us some insight physically into the behavior of the system. So that's something which you'll learn about me, is that I'm quite interested in limiting cases, and you'll often be asked to evaluate them on exams, because limiting cases tell you a lot about the physics and make the math much easier, so you have a chance of doing it in an exam environment. So let's consider a limiting case. The first limiting case is where A is small. If A is small, that implies that the particle is initially localized in space, so we know a lot about its position. If A is small, that of course implies that sine of kA is small, and sine of x in the limit of small x is just approximately equal to x, so sine of kA in the limit of small a will be approximately equal to kA, and as a result, phi, which we see over here is square root of a over pi times sine kA over kA, the kAs will cancel, and this implies that phi in this limiting case is equal to square root a over pi. That is, there's no dependence on k. So this is a flat distribution. If a is small, that tells us that it's localized in space. And that implies that phi, which is telling us the momentum distribution, has a very large spread. Remember, k is just the momentum over h bar, a constant, so a large spread in k implies a large spread in momentum. And so when we're localized in space, that implies we know very little about momentum. So this is clearly consistent with the uncertainty principle. Okay. Everybody see what's going on here? Yeah. Correct.
So, would you assume that sine of kA is equal to kA because the argument of the sine function is small, I guess?
Correct.
But if there's a large spread momentum, then would the argument necessarily be small? Because momentum would be really big?
Yeah. So what we're saying is for a particular value of k, is A goes small? I mean, only in the case where k was infinity would you not know this. But for any finite value of k, if A goes to 0, then kA will also go to 0. So this will be true. The only reason why it works out is because k is in the denominator as well, so the k's cancel. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to say anything about it. But it cancels in this case. That's what saves you. Question?
Yeah, just to back up a step.
Yeah.
Whenever you were formulating the mathematical expression there at the beginning,
yeah.
How do we know that the wave function is a constant across the bounds minus theta?
Yeah, so we're saying we don't know anything other than that it's somewhere in that range. So the first approximation will say that it's a constant probability somewhere between those two points in space. You could have a more complicated dependence on x, and it would just make the math more complicated. So we've made that assumption here as a way to construct the problem. In practice, you would have to make an assumption, or the instructor, that is me, would tell you explicitly what the dependence on x is. Here we're assuming it's flat. If it's something more complicated, like a Gaussian function, the math would just become messier, and the approach would be identical. You get the same qualitative result, and you'll do that actually in the homework for the Gaussian wave packet. The spread of the standard deviation of the Gaussian L curve will be a measure of the localization in space and in momentum space, and you'll see the same Heisenberg uncertainty relationship. In fact, you'll calculate explicitly that the Heisenberg uncertainty principle is satisfied for that case.
Is that a standard thing to do if you have no knowledge about it? We assume that it's black.
I think that's a reasonable thing to say. If no one tells you that it's more complicated than that, we might as well assume it's equally probably anywhere within that region in space. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So we considered one limiting case. Let's do the opposite limiting case. A is large. We need to know something about the sinc function. Remember, sinc is sine ka over ka. What's true about this function is that at ka equal to 0, this is equal to 1. And the first time that it goes down to 0 is where sine ka goes to 0. So this function first drops to 0. At k equals plus or minus pi over a, that's the first time that sine ka goes to 0. So that'll give you a sense of the spread of this function. It's going to be peaked at 0 and then spread out to plus or minus pi over a. What that tells you is that if a is large, then this spike is going to be very sharp, because the first time it drops to 0 will be very small. And as a result, when a is large, this implies that 5k is a sharp spike. About k equals 0. Which tells you that a lot is known about momentum. Momentum is very precisely defined, but now space is very poorly defined. So again, we see what we expect from Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Okay, so let's consider this problem graphically. Let's look at the top figure first, figure 2.8. This is just a plot of the magnitude squared of capital Psi, which we just calculated. Remember, it's an integral which can't be solved analytically, but of course could be evaluated numerically. We know that at t equals 0, this function was just a rectangle. That's how we constructed the problem. And so that's the rectangular curve here. As time evolves at some future value of time, which is precisely here, ma squared over h bar, we see that the wave function is spreading out. And that's something which is going to be common to free particles, that as time evolves, it will tend to spread out in space. Figure 2.9 is considering the case for a small a. That's one of the limiting cases we talked about. In that case, the particle's position is very well known initially. That's the left-hand side. The right-hand side is the Fourier transform, which is phi, which we showed when a is small is a relatively flat distribution. So the probability of finding momentum is relatively flat and very widely distributed. Again, consistent with the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. The final case is the case where we know very little about the position. That is, A is very large, and so it's a flat distribution over most of space. And in that case, phi now becomes a very sharply peaked function. This function here is the so-called sinc function, which has a sharp peak and then these wiggles going out. If you've done Fourier transforms before, you've certainly seen this function. The point is that it's sharply peaked, and so we know a lot about momentum when we know little about position. And so everything is making sense according to Heisenberg. Okay. Now, this is for a particular wave packet. In general, these wave packets will look something like this. So the wave packet is made up of a bunch of sine waves, right? So those sine waves are going to interfere with one another to form a localized function. The envelope is shown here. So within this envelope are, of course, these rapidly varying sine and cosine waves. And what we calculated before was the velocity of one particular sine wave in this wave packet. And that velocity would be given by the frequency of this particular wave. Okay, so that would be the so-called phase velocity. But what matters is how the overall wave packet is moving. That is the velocity of the envelope. And that is known as the group velocity. And so before we show that the phase velocity did not agree with the classical velocity, but of course the phase velocity is not what's relevant, it's the group velocity. So let's calculate the group velocity and see if it agrees with classical physics. Okay. So that's the last thing we're going to do today. Let's calculate the group velocity, which is what's relevant for a quantum system. So we want the group velocity, and we'll calculate this in general. Okay, we're going to start with our general formulation, our general solution, wave packet solution to the free particle. 1 over square root 2 pi, integral minus infinity to infinity of phi, times e to the I, kx minus omega t, dk, where we know that omega is equal to h bar, k squared over 2m. Incidentally, the omega k relationship is known as the dispersion relation. And we have something which is like a free particle, the dispersion relation is quadratic. There are other dispersions, for example, for a photon, the dispersion relation is linear in k. And so that's a common problem, and when we get to the solid state portion of the course, is for me to ask you to rederive some of these equations assuming a linear dispersion relation, and that will describe the behavior of photons as opposed to the behavior of electrons. So keep that in mind. That's a hint for some future exam or something like that. Okay. So assume phi is peaked about some momentum k-naught. And we saw already that phi is typically peaked. We saw the sinc function as an example. Because it's peaked, that allows us to Taylor series expand omega about k-naught. So to first order, the Taylor series expansion of omega, assuming that it's peaked about k-naught, will be omega evaluated at k-naught, which I'm calling omega-naught, plus the derivative of omega with respect to k evaluated at k-naught, which I'm calling omega-naught prime, times k minus k-naught. So this, as I just said, is omega evaluated at k-naught, and this notation is d omega dk evaluated at k equals k-naught. What we're going to do is plug that Taylor series expansion into the group velocity and try to simplify and see if it can tell us how this wave packet is moving. Without doing the math, you can probably see what's going to happen here. In particular, this term omega naught prime is going to win out and give us some information about the group velocity. So let's go ahead and plug it in. Capital psi will be approximately equal to 1 over square root 2 pi, integral minus infinity to infinity. Incidentally, I'm going to do a change of variables. I'm going to let s equal k minus k naught. That's going to simplify the math here. So this will become now phi of k naught plus s, times e to the I k-naught plus x plus s times x minus omega plus omega prime s times t ds. So all I've done is plug in the Taylor series expansion and done this change of variables. Well, then recognize that at t equals 0, this new formulation of the general solution will just be equal to 1 over square root 2 pi integral minus infinity to infinity of phi k naught plus s e to the I k naught plus s times x ds. So I've just let t equal 0, which cancels out this term here. For t greater than 0, capital psi will now approximately be equal to 1 over square root 2 pi. Now I'm going to rearrange the terms in this equation here. E to the I negative omega naught t plus k naught omega naught prime t integral minus infinity to infinity phi k naught plus s e to the I k naught plus s times x minus omega naught prime t ds. Okay? I would recommend that you go ahead and look at this carefully, show that this is actually equivalent to one another. It's just a bunch of algebra that's done here, which I don't want to dwell on since we're limited in time. What I want you to recognize, though, is that this cannot be written in the following form. E to the negative I omega naught minus k naught omega naught prime times t. And this integral here is identical to this integral here, with the difference that x is now replaced by x minus omega naught prime times t. So it's capital psi x minus omega naught prime t comma 0. This term here is just a phase factor, and of course the phase factor will drop out when we take the magnitude squared, which is the only physically relevant parameter. The point is that this wave packet is just like the wave packet at t equals 0, except it's now propagating with some velocity, x minus vt. So v, the velocity of the group, is just omega naught prime. So this implies that the wave packet travels at a speed omega naught prime, right? The equation of motion for a constant velocity particle is just x minus vt, so omega naught prime represents velocity. As a result, the group velocity is just equal to d omega dk, evaluated at k equals k naught. But we know that omega is just h bar k squared over 2m. And as a result, d omega dk is equal to h bar k over m, because the derivative of k squared is 2k, so the 2's cancel. But remember, h bar k is just momentum. Momentum is mass times velocity. And so momentum divided by mass is just equal to the classical velocity. So we see that the classical velocity is equal to the group velocity for a free particle in quantum mechanics. The group velocity is, of course, what's relevant for describing the motion of a free particle. The bottom line is that when you have a free particle, it will move according to the classical equations of motion. This is going to make our life much easier, because when we have an electron in a solid, all we're going to have to do is determine its effective mass. That will allow us to employ the free particle solution and tell us that the particle will move according to the classical equations of motion. This is something which you've been told about since Material Science 101, and that is that most of the motion of charge in a solid obeys classical physics. This is the reason why. The only thing you have to change is the effective mass. So this now justifies, hopefully, what you were taught at a very young age and puts it on a firmer theoretical footing. Okay, chew on that. Think about it. On Monday, I'll be handing out first homework assignment, which will be due a week after that. All right, thanks.
MSE 405.